Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Did you use a cell phone today? If so, you're part of a growing problem. Because of people like you, not to mention broadcasters, the nation's airwaves are getting more and more crowded. So the government's going to make some more of those airwaves for a price. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 28th day of June. Who owns the public airwaves? Well, you do, of course. Sort of. The government licenses those frequencies to broadcasters and wireless companies. But broadcasters have a little extra bandwidth they're not using at the moment. And the government would like some of it back, so it can more than double what's currently available to us as customers. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has the story.
The Obama administration sees dollar signs long before details of the plan have been hashed over. Economic advisor Larry Summers told a Washington audience today that reallocation of this TV and radio spectrum will create hundreds of thousands of jobs.
The knowledge that spectrum is going to be available on a larger scale will spur all kinds of innovation, will spur all kinds of production, even before the spectrum becomes available. And so I would expect the benefits to start from today.
Maybe not if the broadcast industry has its way. Spokesman Dennis Wharton made it clear about the only thing the National Association of Broadcasters likes about the plan is that it's voluntary.
We want to be constructive with the administration and help them achieve their goal of rolling out broadband, but it doesn't have to be at the expense of free and local television.
The broadcasters point out they've already given up a chunk of bandwidth the wireless industry still isn't using, and they have programming plans of their own for the digital spectrum. Meantime, consumer advocates question whether more frequencies will simply be doled out to big wireless carriers with the deepest pockets to bid for it, like AT&T and Verizon. Chris Riley speaks for the advocacy group Free Press, which wants limits to spur competition.
Yes, we'll get investment. Yes, we'll get people being hired to help build out this infrastructure. But the more competitive the mobile broadband market is, the more investment we will get. The more people will be hired, and at the same time, the lower prices consumers will pay for these services and the better quality that they'll get.
Details of the plan could emerge by fall, but political experts say this battle could drag on for years. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Today marked the last day of the Supreme Court's term and the first day of Senate confirmation hearings for nominee Elena Kagan. The justices had a going-away ceremony for retiring Justice John Paul Stevens, and, yes, they issued some opinions, one of which upheld the Enron-era Sarbanes-Oxley law and the regulator it created, called the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. Brett Neely reports from Washington.
The board often goes by its initials, PCAOB. But sometimes it's also known as peekaboo. Today's decision means peekaboo won't be disappearing, despite the best efforts of Ilya Shapiro and others. He's a constitutional law expert at the libertarian Cato Institute and filed a friend of the court brief arguing that the board was unconstitutional.
Congress created this fourth or fifth branch of government that was the investigator, the prosecutor, the judge, the executioner, the tax man, everything. It had all sorts of authority that was not checked by anyone.
The justices who supported today's 5-4 decision were the court's conservative majority. But Shapiro thought they didn't go far enough.
It's half a loaf.
Half a loaf because Shapiro would have preferred to get rid of the board. Instead, the court merely tightened the oversight of the executive branch over the board, but otherwise didn't challenge the board or the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Duke law professor James Cox says large companies will now have to resign themselves to working with a powerful and highly independent regulator. And he sees a surprising victory for regulation in today's decision.
So much of that New Deal thinking that gave rise to the creation of independent regulatory agencies in the 1930s reaffirmed by this court, a conservative court.
In a statement, the board's chairman said the decision means it's business as usual for peekaboo. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Robert Byrd, the longest-serving member of the Senate and a tireless fighter for his home state of West Virginia, died early this morning. Amid the tributes that poured forth all day, there was also a hint of ghoulish exasperation. With Byrd's death, it is by no means certain that there are enough senators to vote yes on the financial reform bill. Meanwhile, all the major players are trying to figure out what's really in the bill. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
The financial regulations aren't what you'd call a good beach read. But for a certain set, bankers, lawyers, consultants, regulators, they're a must-read, a 4,000-page one.
A lot of people have been poring over it. There were changes right up to the last minute, and people are still digesting what exactly those things mean.
Oliver Ireland is in the financial services practice at Morrison & Forrester. It's a law firm. He says it's not enough to just read the bill.
You then have to go back and you have to look at what the existing structure is and what's being changed, and then think about what the effect of the change is going to be.
Most of the financial world has been poring over this for months, and now that they're pretty sure what's going to be in the bill, they're cramming again. Most firms divided up the reading, then they'll compare notes to make sure they're really getting the full picture. David Nason is at Promontory Financial. It's a financial services consulting firm.
I mean, first things first, every client wants to make sure that they're complying with the law. And then the second thing is, okay, what do we need to do to maximize our ability to continue to earn money?
That could take a while. The bill still has to get signed into law. And then the regulators need to write the rules, which means everybody will have to start studying up again. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, investors worried about cautious consumer spending. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The medical community has been warning for years that we all take too many antibiotics because the more we throw at these bugs we're trying to kill, the more quickly they evolve to beat those drugs. Now the battle against so-called antibiotic resistance is going down on the farm. Today, the Food and Drug Administration issued new guidelines designed to reduce the antibiotics fed to cows, pigs, and chickens. Jeff Horwich reports.
Before we eat the vast majority of animals in this country, they've been eating antibiotics. Jeff Bender directs the Center for Animal Health and Food Safety at the University of Minnesota.
We know that if we feed these at these really low levels, somehow these animals don't get disease and they grow faster.
Faster and bigger, says Missouri farmer Richard Oswald.
Antibiotic feeding does stimulate the appetite of the animal somewhat, so they tend to eat more than they would normally if they were just out on their own.
The FDA says all those antibiotics have contributed to drug-resistant strains of E. coli, salmonella, and other deadly bacteria. So today, the agency said fattening livestock for market is no longer a good enough reason to give antibiotics. New draft regulations say they must be medically necessary and overseen by a veterinarian. It's a challenge to the large factory farms that supply most of the nation's meat. The University of Minnesota's Jeff Bender says where animals are tightly packed, the diet of antibiotics keeps disease from spreading.
This is going to require some innovation by the industry to think about, what does this mean for us? Does this mean less animals that we have in confined spaces?
Bender calls the FDA guidelines an important step. Just down the hall, his colleague, veterinary epidemiologist Randy Singer, worries it may be a backward step.
I am concerned if we pull antibiotics out of the feed of animals that we'll see an increase in the illness of these animals on the farms, and therefore we will need more antibiotics at higher doses.
Singer says that's what happened when the EU made the same move 4 years ago. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
A good chunk of the population, at least here in L.A., got an early jump on the holiday by taking this week off. I know this because my commute to work was half what it usually is. Summer vacation season is upon us. Time to hit the beach, catch a movie, perhaps read a book. So today we kick off our week-long summer book series. Five Marketplace regulars tell us one book, any book, they're reading this summer. First up, economist Betsy Stephenson.
For me, a good vacation involves nonfiction, a novel, and some short stories. In past years, that's meant hauling an overweight bag. But this year, I'll be taking my Kindle. so my bags will be lighter, but my selection larger. My nonfiction choice this summer is Tara Parker Pope's book, For Better, The Science of a Good Marriage. My family will tease me for taking work on vacation. You see, I'm an economist whose main research is on marriage. And for full disclosure, my work is discussed in the book. But I can't wait. The book is amazing. Parker Pope pulls together research on marriage from across disciplines. While I naturally think that economists have interesting insights into marriage, it's fun to hear what psychologists, anthropologists, biologists, and neurologists have learned. For instance, we economists consider things like how marriage is affected by our social circumstances. For example, the unemployment rate or how easy it is to meet people. But we don't have much to say about the smell of someone's sweat, which biologists say helps us sniff out people who are good genetic matches. Parker Pope brings the insights from these fields and others together to paint a vivid picture of marriage. But it's not just blue sky science. She boils these findings down into practical tips for making the most of your relationship. I expect this combination to give me better insights into both my research and my personal life, which is why I call it vacation reading. As for the rest of my books, I'm still mulling my options, and I welcome your suggestions.
Betsy Stevenson is an assistant professor of economics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Help us build the ultimate summer reading list. Visit marketplace.org to submit your recommendations and reviews. Coming up, a history of oil spills.
We don't learn as a society, as a nation, from these horrible events that we've all seen now occurring on the TV in front of us. We are not ready for them with the latest science and technology.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow dipped by 5 points today. We'll call that flat to finish at 10,138. The Nasdaq lost 2 points, 0.1%, to close at 2220. And the S&P 500 inched up 1.1% to end the day at 1078. J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley were all down 2%. B of A was off more than 1%. Citigroup cashed in, though, with a 1.5% gain. President Obama's move to free up wireless spectrum for smartphones was good news for telecom companies. Sprint Nextel dialed up more than 6%. Verizon rang up a 0.5% gain. And American Tower Corporation erected a 3% gain. Bonds gained as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.02%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. A House committee holds a hearing on the safety of hazardous liquid pipelines. President Obama meets with King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. And 57 years ago, workers in Flint, Michigan started assembling the first Corvette. The first sports car took 2 days to put together. I'm Cormac O'Connor.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. It was all smiles at the final photo shoot to end the G20 summit in Toronto yesterday. The summit declaration was cordial. It contained broad agreements on issues like stimulus spending and bank regulation. But the communique took 45 hours to draft, so it is not all sunshine and light. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
So we heard a lot about a rift between the U.S. and Europe in the run-up to the summit. Did we settle some of those differences here?
No, I think the leaders have agreed to disagree. Mm. The communique papers over the obvious cracks in the G20, over this question of to cut or to spend. It commits the rich countries to cut their budget deficits in half by 2013, but the US and some developing countries have succeeded in getting a commitment in there to growth and recovery as well, a commitment to continue the stimulus spending if need be. So a government that failed to cut its deficit in half by 2013 could claim that it was worried about derailing its recovery, and that would let it off the hook.
So a rule with a whole bunch of exceptions.
Very much so.
What about bank regulation? Another big source of disagreement among some of the G20 members. Those differences resolved yet?
They have agreed to raise significantly the amount of capital that banks will need to hold so they can withstand a crisis without running to the taxpayers to bail them out. Mm-hmm. But there are no firm details or numbers yet. This is actually, to be more accurate, an agreement to agree at a later date. We're going to have to wait until the G20 summit in Korea in November for the full story. And there are still a lot of differences on the issue of banking. There's been no agreement on a special bank tax, for example, something that the Europeans are pushing for.
So what are the veteran summit watchers saying about the Toronto G20? Failure? Success?
Not a failure, no. But the consensus view seems to be that it's been nothing as successful as the G20 summit in London last year, when there was an almost universal agreement on the need for the stimulus spending. But Stephen Lewis, chief economist of brokerage house Monument Securities, says that level of agreement between the G20 leaders was only natural back then at the height of the crisis.
It was the threat that really brought them together, which united them in a joint purpose. Now that has gone, then they're going their separate ways, pursuing the policies which they think are best for their own countries.
But at the very least, Stephen, the summit seems to have been reasonably amicable, everyone playing well in the sandbox together?
Yes, a small mercy. And it helps explain why financial markets have been relatively calm today. If there'd been any sign of an open disagreement or a widening rift, it could have been disastrous. Stephen Lewis claims that it was a rift at a G7 meeting in 1987, which helped trigger the stock market crash that year. So the markets seem, at least in Europe, to have been reassured by the appearance of unity and agreement, even if beneath the communique, that's not the reality.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard joining us from London. Thanks so much.
Okay, Tess.
Cash stashed in suitcases and sent out of the country on airplanes? Sounds like the latest thriller out of Hollywood, but it's actually the latest story of alleged corruption in Afghanistan. Billions of dollars are reportedly being flown out of the country, some of it diverted U.S. aid. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Some of your tax dollars could be winging their way to Dubai. The Wall Street Journal reported today that more than $3 billion has been tucked into suitcases or packed on pallets in Afghanistan and flown to foreign banks over the past 3 years. The Journal says the U.S. government thinks Afghan officials are behind the airlift of diverted American aid and drug money. How did we let this happen?
We just have a lot of contractors in theater doing a lot of different things that the government used to do.
That's Stephen Schooner. He teaches procurement law at George Washington University. He says the U.S. government hires American contractors to hand out foreign aid and logistics money in Afghanistan. That used to be done mostly by State Department employees, but safety became an issue. Moyara Rusin teaches international finance at the Monterey Institute of International Studies.
And so we have tried to have people on the ground dispersing aid money, and lives have been lost.
And there's an incentive to hire Afghans. The U.S. wants to support local businesses, but those companies play by Afghan rules. Brian Fishman is a counterterrorism expert at the New America Foundation.
And Afghan rules for a long time now has meant a lot of corruption and paying off armed factions so that you can build a road or move trucks along a road or those sorts of things.
Or airlift money out of the country. The government of Afghanistan says it's going to investigate. So is Congress. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Residents and cleanup crews along the Gulf Coast are watching closely as Tropical Storm Alex churns its way toward shore. More than 40 years ago, all eyes were on a different spill off the coast of Santa Barbara. It was 1969, and an oil platform blew, spewing 3 million gallons of crude into the Pacific. As Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, some of the lessons learned in the intervening years did not stick.
On the morning of January 28, 1969, James Bottoms got a phone call from a friend who worked for the local newspaper. An oil rig had just exploded off the Santa Barbara coast. Bottoms had been fishing, diving, and sailing in these waters for years. The first day, he says, he could spot only specks of oil coming in.
And then it came ashore in great gobs. And I remember going down to one of my favorite swimming beaches and just standing there crying. Our whole life has changed completely.
The Santa Barbara spill was small compared to the disaster in the Gulf today, but the images of dead sea lions and suffocating dolphins shocked the American public. Thousands of volunteers pitched in to clean up 35 miles of tarred coastline. They soaked up the oil with hay.
They spread hay all over the harbor and out in the water and pick up the black straw with pitchforks, load it into trucks and haul it out of here.
Bottoms helped start a grassroots movement that eventually led to a drilling moratorium off most of the country's coastal waters. The president of Union Oil, the well's owner, did his part to galvanize environmentalists. Here's his most famous quote after the spill, reenacted.
I don't like to call it a disaster because there's been no loss of human life. I am amazed at the publicity for the loss of a few birds.
Reminiscent of Tony Hayward's I Want My Life Back, but the Santa Barbara oil spill also taught a lesson. Federal officials had allowed Union Oil to skimp on the well's protective casings. After the spill, the feds demanded more safety devices and, for the first time, ordered they be tested. The industry snapped to attention. Byron King is an energy analyst at Agora Financial. He says within months, offshore drillers held their first convention.
The people of the offshore development industry got together in a relatively small hotel ballroom in Houston, because it was not a very large industry back then. And they got together and said, man, something really bad happened out there. We have to figure this out and we have to do a better job as an industry.
Safety did improve. So did the technology. King says those annual get-togethers spawned a spirit of cooperative competition, and the industry took off.
In the Gulf of Mexico, rain and heavy seas are hampering efforts to cap a Mexican oil well. It has been
1979, 10 years after Santa Barbara. The so-called Ixtoc well suffered a blowout. The blowout preventer failed to stop a leak far bigger than the one in Santa Barbara. It took the Mexican oil giant Pemex almost 10 months to plug the well.
Mexican officials are calling it Operation Sombrero. Workers have been trying since the weekend to put a 300-ton steel cone over the mouth of the runaway well.
Sound familiar? That method failed to contain the spill, just like it did for BP last month. Rick Steiner is a marine biologist who studied the effects of oil spills. He says Ixtoc should have been a huge wake-up call for regulators and industry.
And it really wasn't. They sort of dismissed it as a real threat in the U.S. And the U.S. offshore drillers were quite pompous and arrogant about their technological prowess, saying that this could never happen in the United States.
In fact, the same year Ixtoc exploded, Shell Oil set a record, drilling in over 1,000 feet of water in the Gulf. By 2003, Chevron Texaco was drilling 10,000 feet down in ultra-deep water. Tad Patzik is a top petroleum engineer and professor at the University of Texas.
So this is an extremely difficult, harsh environment, and the technology that works in this environment can only be compared in its complexity to technology that we used in space.
But as drilling technology evolved, planning for worst-case scenarios lagged. Regulators knew the risks of deep water drilling and about finicky blowout preventers. But over the years, regulators and the companies they policed had developed a cozy relationship. At its worst, it led to scandals involving drug use, sex, and illegal gifts. But it wasn't just lax regulation at fault. For years, offshore drillers had managed to avoid catastrophic deep water spills. Success led to complacency. Even the president was convinced the risks were minimal.
It turns out, by the way, that oil rigs today generally don't cause spills. They are technologically very advanced.
That was 18 days before the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded. The industry's successes also dispelled any sense of urgency over funding better containment and cleanup technology. Ira Leifer is a researcher at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He has struggled to get oil companies to fund his research into better containment booms, partly, he believes, because they see no profit in it.
The end result of this attitude is we don't learn as a society, as a nation, from these horrible events that we've all seen now occurring on the TV in front of us. We are not ready for them with the latest science and technology.
Biologist Rick Steiner says past spills point to the need for strong federal oversight and stepped-up research. But if those are the only lessons we've learned, he'll be disappointed.
I've seen these offshore fields all over the world, and I'm starting to worry that no matter how safe we make them, there is still a marginal risk of a catastrophe like the Deepwater Horizon. Therefore, don't we have better alternatives than that?
At the moment, well, no. Petroleum engineers point out we're drilling in risky waters because onshore oil production is declining around the world, but our thirst for petroleum isn't. By the end of this decade, up to 40% of our oil could be produced offshore. It's up to us to decide, every time we fill our tanks, whether deep water drilling is worth it. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And for a slideshow and reporter's notebook on the Santa Barbara spill, go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, airline passengers complain loudly about all the new fees they have to pay, while service on board gets stingier and stingier. You still hear grumbling in the waiting area about how the evil airlines took away our hot meals. But keep this in mind next time you're tempted to join the kvetching. USA Today sifted through some FDA documents and found health violations at three of the biggest airline catering companies, including the presence of cockroaches, mice, and unsanitized equipment. Small bag of pretzels, anyone? And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 5 points, pretty much flat. The NASDAQ dropped 2 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 added 1 point, also 0.1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, how's this for a business model?
Absolutely. No profits. No profits to date and no profits for the foreseeable future.
Tesla Motors goes public. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.